Hi, this is Dark Journalist. Today we have the exciting Part 2 follow-up episode with former U.S. Assistant Housing Secretary Catherine Austin Fitz on the transhumanist agenda and the re-engineering of reality by deep state forces that are working for an opportunity to dismantle the Constitution. Now, in Part 1, we concentrated on the upcoming political battle between neocon Democrat Hillary Clinton and financial insider Donald Trump. In this episode, we'll go deep into the forces working behind the scenes and why their endgame ends in space. Is the advent of robotics and the war on cash being conducted in order to install a global control grid? Here we go. Former U.S. Assistant Housing Secretary Catherine Austin Fitz, Space Wars and Matrix Reality.
For many decades now, we've been centralizing the economy in a way that shrinks total wealth. If Mr. Global wants one thing, it's a constitutional convention and the ability to change the U.S. Constitution.
You know, in an era where the public is demanding change from the usual political and structural corruption, how does the deep state respond to our rising awareness and the savvy research and independent media? One of the major tactics they can use is the deep entrainment embedded in the corporate media and entertainment circles. The mainstream media wants it to be trendy to label countries as racists that seek their own independence, and to drive fears of financial calamity if the average citizens reject their plans. Yet opportunities like the ones we face in 2016 are hard to come by. The deep state is ready to play, are we? Let's go ask Catherine Austin Fitz.
Dark Journalist will go there. The deepest issues, the hardest stories, the biggest secrets. The truth is never easy. With top guests, like former Assistant Housing Secretary Catherine Austin Fitz.
Catherine, who is really behind this media censorship?
Internet feeds go through satellites. Who controls the satellites? It's the Pentagon.
Legendary investigator Graham Hancock.
Graham, this cataclysm must have destroyed an advanced culture in our ancient past.
It truly was an extinction-level event. It was accompanied by massive animal extinctions. It was accompanied by huge and unexplained sea level rises, and then a sudden plunge of global temperatures.
Best-selling author Jim Mars.
Jim, don't these elite corporate owners need us around to buy their GMO food? Why would they want to depopulate?
Because they are eugenicists and they believe that they need to purify the human race. And if that sounds like the Nazis, that's exactly what it is.
Coast to Coast AM investigative reporter Linda Moulton Howe.
Linda, how are we going to scale that wall of UFO secrecy?
Humans themselves are bypassing, are beginning to dismiss all of the policies of denial and lies.
Dark journalists will go there. Visit darkjournalist.com and subscribe now for a special summer discount available for just $39 for one full year. You'll not only receive access to the complete audio archives to stream or download at your convenience, you'll also get exclusive subscriber-only content and Dark Journalist event discounts. Sign up for our free newsletter to stay updated on the latest shows. Dark Journalist. Let's get the real story in 2016.
You know, we need dark journalists, so just keep doing what you're doing.
Well, hello everyone. We're back with part two here. And before we get started, I wanted to thank all of you for your excellent response and the emails and comments from part one. I have to say you really are the savviest viewers out there, and I'm still catching up to all your excellent questions, so bear with me on some of those. And remember to sign up for the Dark Journalist newsletter at darkjournalist.com so I can keep you updated with the latest videos and news or events that are happening. And, you know, we have one heck of a summer of shows coming up for you, so make sure you get there first. And here we go now into part two with Catherine Austin Fitz. Catherine, it's great to have you back for part two of our deep discussion on the transhumanist agenda and the deep state. I guess one question I wanted to follow up on from part one, you know, we were getting so much into a potential Hillary Clinton presidency there. And I guess the question that I wanted to ask you on that was, what is your biggest fear of a Hillary Clinton presidency?
The Clinton Cash Book, I don't know if you've read it. It's quite remarkable.
I have it here, yeah.
Here's the big question for me on Clinton that scares me, although the deep state feels they must feel that they have the answer. If I'm a member of the intelligence community or a member of the enforcement community that's got to go out and handle either sensitive or covert operations, I'm going to be scared to death, because if the Clintons have their own servers, share information, use it to engage in global racketeering, whether it's speaking fees for Bill or donations to the foundation, you know, I'm putting my life at risk, and it's not safe, because if they're doing it, then their cabinet, sub-cabinet are going to do it.
Right.
And you're basically putting a for sale sign on the White House. And if I was the bureaucracy, I'd shut down, because it's not safe.
Absolutely. Well, is there any rhyme or reason you can see for Hillary to make this kind of absurd error in judgment on this in-house server and moving all these emails there? You know, risk exposure, risk espionage, something doesn't add up there. What reason do you think they could have for moving these classified communications to a kind of flimsy home server arrangement?
I just think they wanted to engage in private racketeering. Mm-hmm. And they wanted to coordinate between Bill's efforts and the, you know, so Hillary's running for president and they're collecting up money for the network and for that initiative. And they're doing a variety of different things for the deep state. And they have permission to do that from the deep state and or from their part of it, their syndicate. And they just wanted to have their hands free to keep things confidential to themselves.
Well, this is a fascinating pattern of arrogance here. And the assumption, you know, that they can get away with anything and get out of any situation is really testing the limits this time. Between that and what we've seen in the previous episode on the Clinton Foundation and what you ran down there, not a very desirable picture for a presidential candidate.
Clinton's disapproval ratings are 56 or 57%.
Yeah.
So, I mean, those are astonishing disapproval rates.
Definitely.
And you know, both Trump and Clinton have remarkably, you know, the majority of Americans disapprove of them. So.
Yeah, and they do seem out of sync age-wise with the regular pattern around presidents. You know, both Bush and Obama were right around 50 when they got in,
right. And
Bill Clinton, even younger than that. So, you know, we both know incredible people doing work into their 70s and beyond, of course. But it is odd to have the presidential nominees both around 70. It's not the shift that we'd really expect with all these millennials and these other factors working into this election.
If you look at the ideal age for a president in this environment, you want somebody in their 40s.
Right.
You know, maybe in their 50s. You don't want somebody in their 60s. You certainly don't want somebody in their 70s. I'm not saying people that age can't do it, but it is a physically very demanding job in terms of travel or just stress. And because you're going through a period of radical change, you want somebody who's either unbelievably experienced and capable, you know, and the establishment trusts, or you want somebody who's young and really understands the changes and is ready to reach out and really work effectively globally.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, so you've got two candidates who don't fit that profile, and you've got two candidates who have very high disapproval ratings. And if they really bring transparency to each other and their backgrounds, their disapproval ratings will be 90% by the time.
Right. Well, there's no question about that. Well, let's go a little deeper into the Hillary campaign now, since we're really getting into it here. They are pointing out in the media that one of her main potential VP picks, in addition to Elizabeth Warren, who I think is really just there as a stooge to make Bernie supporters have hope. It's empty hope, in my opinion. But we're seeing Julian Castro, the head of HUD, the Housing and Urban Development Department, being floated out there as a VP choice. Now, you've enlightened all of us with your years as Jack Kemp's assistant secretary of HUD. And I've thought about the Oliver North quote that HUD is the candy store for the black budget. And I guess my question here is, are we seeing a return to the MENA, Arkansas? You know, is this a flashback to when the Clintons were involved in the Contra drug running operations that went through Arkansas? And are they playing this kind of HUD fraud card?
Well, here's a guess. and this is just a guess, I think that the Clintons have always, if you look at their operations and the Democrats, part of this is Democrats, have always lined up with mortgages and mortgage fraud.
All right.
I think the reason for the choice of the guy at HUD is they're looking for a Hispanic. And I think she also wants to do something with communities and making communities wonderful and building up place-based equity. And, you know, she's going to do, you know, that's all part of the Women's Credit. So you're going to come back around. If you look at Warren Buffett's operation or Gates' operation, they're all lined up to re-engineer places. So healthcare, education, real estate by place. And they've, you know, they're clearly lining up to re-engineer all aspects of local investment management. And you want a very fluffy, wonderful, you know, sort of woman's picture on the front of that. And so a guy from HUD and Hispanic, you know, that helps you do the Hispanic thing. And that helps you, you know, take the Democratic mortgage community development machinery and go in for another harvest.
Well, when I first heard that they were potentially going to choose this guy, I kept thinking to myself, you know, keeping your experience at HUD in mind, well, you know, they're probably choosing this guy because he knows so much about the fraud system there, and he'd be kind of a key person to utilize it.
I don't think it's so much knowing the HUD fraud, it's knowing local development.
Okay.
So America breaks down into 3,100 counties, and if you're going to re-engineer the federal budget, you have to do it one county at a time. So having somebody who understands the federal, state, and local nexus and understands community money, and of course, a lot of it organizes around real estate and mortgages. So I don't think that it's necessarily because he knows the covert side. It's probably because he knows the overt side. I don't know how much of the covert side he knows.
Right. I hear what you're saying. He may be a useful tool, and then they'll just keep the covert stuff on a higher level.
Yeah.
Now, I do find the tone of this campaign and some of these bombshells that get thrown out there, like the autism connection to vaccines and the 28-page classified report on 9/11, this is such unusual rhetoric in a campaign. And I've been watching them closely for a while. I've never seen anything like it, and I know that we said in the last episode that Trump was fueling part of this transparency as a way to stay one step ahead of the opposition, but what is happening there? You know, is it an attempt to co-opt the issues so people feel they're getting, you know, the real deal and not being left out?
We keep trying to hook people back into believing it's a legitimate process. So you're trying to, one, the media wants it to be entertaining. And what you want to avoid is people leaving and not paying attention because you're irrelevant. I mean, I happen to believe that James Baker is dead on, right? It's irrelevant. The whole thing is it's a show, it's entertainment. What's relevant is who your local sheriff is and who your local mayor is and who your local county administrator is. So if I were you, I'd be paying attention to making sure you had control of your county, and I would ignore the show. But the reality is you're trying to get as many eyeballs in, and you're trying to hook them back in by opening up cracks in the dam in the official story.
So, okay, it's entertainment for them, but it is a kind of attempt to subtly draw in these people who are waking up to the official story by imitating these independent media websites like ForbiddenKnowledgeTV.net or Solari or Dark Journalist, for example. They're making these head fake gestures toward the independent media. And I find that very compelling.
Somebody sent me a chart the other day that showed that the online media now has more employment than the traditional media.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So the traditional media is just trying to fight back and get market share.
I see.
And I don't, you know, unless they're planning on working their way up to some kind of disclosure about the black budget and what's going on behind it, you know, which is possible, but who knows?
Well, maybe it's a recognition that the electorate is a little more clued in and that they have to at least pander to that on some level. Now, what is the challenge for the establishment forces facing a rising tide of public awareness?
The challenge is, Daniel, let's look at the money, and I'm going to oversimplify to keep it simple. For many decades now, we've been centralizing the economy in a way that shrinks total wealth, but it centralizes it. So it centralizes wealth, and it supports certain corporations, but it shrinks the total pie. Now, the way we've pulled that off economically is just by spending more government money, borrowing more government money, and subsidizing it. So if you go down to Walmart in the county where I live, you know, it is EBT nation. Everybody's lined up, and, you know, and everybody's getting a check for the government, and that's how the economy works. And so if you look at the federal budget, it's been the plug. It's been plugging this game. And the problem is the centralization is happening in a way that's not economic, and it's been getting away with it politically because of the plug. And so now you're running out of juice on the plug.
Okay.
In 2017, Congress is going to come back in, the election's going to be over, and the question is, okay, are we going to start doing things according to what's productive, or are we just going to ream everybody in the budget? Because we can't just increase the plug. That game's over. And so we've been, you know, not facing the productivity issue because we could add to the plug. And now that we can't add to the plug, what's it going to be?
So basically, they're down to these last two options, and the money printing show is just over.
Right. So this is all going to come out in the federal budget next year, which is why if you're a particular cartel in the establishment, you want to control the federal budget, because if somebody's going to get reamed, you want to make sure it's not you.
Right. Okay.
The whole reason, the whole excuse to keep this game going was, oh, well, we have to do all this stuff on a covert basis. We can't tell everybody, it needs to be secret. And the reason we can run this highly unproductive, inefficient game that makes this group of insiders very, very wealthy, unnecessarily, I might add, is because we need to keep everything secret. And so you've got massive decreases in productivity coming from secrecy and privilege coming out of this game around the federal budget. And it's all going to come to a head next year. Now, you know, the theory is, we'll just keep the military happy and the creditors happy, and we'll cut all the retirees, and that'll solve the problem. Well, that's a political problem.
Yes, definitely. Well, they may awaken the sleeping giant there if they're not careful. So if we assume for the moment that Clinton gets in, and then flash forward 4 years down the road to America in 2020, what are we looking at there? Because in so many of your reports, you have these interesting and very detailed studies on the impact of robotics on employment and displacing many workers from their jobs. And of course, the robotics and the new tech aren't all bad. But for the middle class and blue collar workers, it's shaping up to become a very strained and difficult picture.
Right.
Now, what do you see America looking like in 2020 if they continue down this path?
Daniel, I have no idea, because corporations, you have places. And the corporations can use all that technology to become much more efficient. That's part of why I think the equity markets are going to do well. Then, of course, the question is, what about places? And we've been harvesting places to build up the corporations. So the question is, what do we do with places, and how do we take advantage of the opportunity in places? And that is a matter of government policy, because the matter of government policy is we've basically been pretty much wrecking most of our places. Are we going to change? If you look at the plans, if you look at what the establishment says, the way they would say it is as follows. We need to massively increase productivity in healthcare, education, and in government. Now, if you look at their plans to increase efficiency and productivity in healthcare, education, and government, they're basically going to double down on what they've been doing. It's basically, let's pass government mandates that force everybody to pay Bill Gates and Warren Buffett to do it for us.
Right.
I'm nasty and exaggerating. But government mandates aren't going to do it. So the way it looks like they're going about it is, to me, there's going to be a revolution. I think that's why they want to pull in the guns. I mean, if you're mandating that children get autism, and you're mandating that they go to school and don't learn math, and you're mandating that they pay for healthcare insurance when they don't need healthcare insurance, they need healthcare. You're basically talking about a depopulation policy.
That's a cold endgame.
I hate to say.
Yeah, so their policies are totalitarian in nature.
Right, and it's a highly complex fascism. A lot of it done through the information systems, and Hillary Clinton is just a person to put a fluffy picture on him. Is what it looks like. But how it goes down, I don't know, because the scenarios are many, and in theory, there's a great deal that could be done to dramatically improve productivity, which doesn't threaten the deep state.
Mm-hmm.
So there are ways that it could really work. At this point, it looks to me like the communication between the establishment. Here's the problem. If you would allow into leadership positions the establishment who didn't engineer the coup d'etat, I mean, you've got lots of honest, hardworking, decent people within the establishment who aren't responsible for engineering the financial coup. If you would let them run things instead of, you know, taking the poster child for corruption in the United States and stuffing it in our face, you know, there are ways of getting mammoth productivity, you know, and basically re-engineering the relationship between place-based equity and corporate equity on a win-win basis, you know, and you have an explosive wealth creation situation, which is good for everybody. And we'll have support of the general population.
Right.
So it doesn't have to go down ugly. If you look at what's planned, whether it's the Clinton campaign or the Trump campaign or what the business leadership is doing in the software in Silicon Valley, you know, it looks to me like they're planning on very, very ugly.
Yeah.
I mean, it looks to me like they're planning on, you know, a transhumanist depopulation.
Well, that is just fascinating. And I know you don't say things like that lightly. It's based on your deep analysis and research. I guess the eerie thing here is, like with your forecast of a slow burn economy, you tend to be unusually accurate with how you see the trends developing. So now one thing I found in your latest report that ties in with this is this war on cash that's going on. You know, we see this coming from the top down, and it's being implemented in a number of ways. The replacing of Andrew Jackson with Harriet Tubman coming up on the $20 bill, I think, is the same kind of oblique reference to this kind of war that's going on under the surface. Why are we seeing a war on cash?
You're going after cash for a couple reasons. One is, if you want to issue a global currency, you need to dramatically bring down transaction costs. There's no way the frontier markets and the emerging markets can afford the transaction costs that we pay in the Western world. So you need something that's going to go globally. And to do that, you've got to get the transaction costs way down, which means you need technology. Now, if you look at what blockchain technology is and how it works, in theory, you ought to be able to dramatically reduce the cost of financial transaction and all sorts of different aspects of the financial system. And it's just too profitable not to take advantage of it. It's going to happen. So there are a lot of legitimate reasons why you want to bring down those costs and make things digital. But there's no doubt about it, too. It's a control point. And if I can, you know, I've never seen the deep state let a technology like blockchain go out where they didn't have a back door. So,
right. Yeah.
Software guys hate me because I'm always saying they got a back door. I don't care what you say. They got a back door. But if you can backdoor that kind of digital technology, it's the world's greatest PowerPoint. If you think you can harvest a lot with digital technology now, wait till you see what you can do with fiat currencies with, you know, an all-digital currency. So it's the ultimate intelligence-generating machine. So I think, yeah, they do want to see the end of privacy, and you absolutely can – you know, it's the mark of the beast. You can turn somebody's money off if they don't play ball. So you're talking about an amazing control system. So yeah, I think they want to reduce cash for economic reasons and then for political control reasons.
And the what do you think the odds are that that will work? I mean, do you see people being upset that they're not using cash or they're being mandated not to use cash? How would that play out, do you think?
I've watched people be furious about this for the last 20 years. So my personal experience, Daniel, is the American people are furious. Mm-hmm. They're deeply angry and they are really furious. And they just don't know what to do.
Yeah, so Mr. Global would really be making a big mistake trying to pull cash. This would be the kind of overreach that risks exposure, and suddenly everyone is on to your global control grid plan.
Well, if you look at what Mr. Global wants, you know, one, he wants to pull cash and he wants to pull guns, but he can eat away at it slowly. You know, keep, you know, for example, we just saw a rule coming out saying seniors who were disabled couldn't have guns. And, you know, so you're going to chip away at it in the regulatory bureaucracy so you don't have to come at it frontally. So they're going to chip away and then try and change attitudes over time. I think what they want to, if Mr. Global wants one thing, it's a constitutional convention and the ability to change the U.S. Constitution. And I think after the election, the priority will be they'll keep chipping away at guns and keep chipping away at money. But if they can make it fashionable to revise and redo the Constitution, that's where they're going to get their big shift. And if they could get it at the same time that they have to re-engineer the federal budget, that would be beautiful. Because then they can, you know, they can create a constitutional construct where they basically individuals don't have sovereignty and they can get all these things done quickly.
Right. Even with the Patriot Act and other legislation, they still need to undermine the Constitution further if they're to really centralize the system. Now, some people watching are already very politically minded and will know, you know, the way that things are going and what's coming up. They might read your reports. And then other people with a busy schedule, they might be working in an average kind of environment, and they probably get time to browse Solari or watch Dark Journalist. What can they do, either of these groups, to counter these controlling trends that are coming at them?
If there's anything you want to fight, it's no changes to the Constitution, no constitutional convention. Please don't make that fashionable. Don't support it. And fight gun control. And, well, on health freedom or any of these freedoms, you want to protect individual sovereignty to the extent you can. But if they compromise the Constitution, they'll be able to do all of them quickly.
So this is really where the lines are drawn in the battle between the centralization team and the decentralization team. It's in the mandated vaccine push, the push for invasive surveillance, excessive gun control, and the gradual elimination of cash. Right. This is where you see this process playing out.
Right. So it's also about not just what the law is, but who has to obey the law. So the Clintons don't have to obey the law. You know, there's one group of people, as long as they're making money for the deep state, they don't have to obey the law.
Right.
And the attitude, if you look at sort of the rest of the population, not only do we have to obey the law, but there's more law every day that we have to obey. So the regulatory compliance is exploding. You know, it's so bad you even have corporate CEOs saying they're not going to reinvest because the regulatory compliance is too horrible. So so there's a discrepancy in terms of who has to obey the rule of law. That's a big problem. It's a very big problem for productivity.
Right. And something that you mentioned in your report is that digital systems are the most lawless of all.
Totally lawless. Cybersecurity and cyber warfare is now costing the digital economy. It's estimated to be over $450 billion a year.
Incredible.
And it's really funny, Daniel, because I always ask this question. If you look at what's happening with cybersecurity and cyber warfare, my personal experience, I'm sure your experience, is basically the digital systems have very little integrity.
Yes.
And in fact, if you talk with a lot of the software development community, they think they live in the Wild West. Anything goes. If they can get away with it, it's okay. So it's really a kind of Wild West culture. And, you know, I always say if the utility guys had the same attitude as the software guys, everybody in America would be dead from electrocution. So we have these systems that don't have integrity. If you look at the leadership plans, whether it's driverless cars or the Internet of Things or your house all working off the Internet of Things, they're planning on doing everything on these systems. And these two forces of let's do everything on the systems and the system having no integrity are kind of going at each other like these two economic tsunamis. And I'm watching them get closer and closer, and I'm wondering, how's this supposed to work?
Huh. Yeah. Yeah. Where is it going?
I don't know.
Well, there's a recent report out, actually, that a group is selling 33 million Twitter passwords on the dark web. So that really backs up what you're saying about digital systems.
So I suggest that we buy Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump's Twitter passwords and have a little fun. What do you think?
Oh, yeah. At Hillary, at Trump. Let's sign in tonight. So to highlight something else from your Where to Stash the Cash report now, Bitcoin is something you have in there, and you've studied that hard. Of course, that's another one of those that goes into this digital wallet idea. But it's really seen as more of an indie currency in many ways, I suppose it is. But you see a number of dangers in it.
I get these terrifying moments when somebody calls me and says, you know, I can't trust the banking system. The banking system is not trustworthy. I'm going to take all my money out of the bank and I'm going to buy Bitcoin. And I say, wait a minute. The bank has been there for 100 years. It has a, you know, it has a board of governors and trustees and a layer of management that is very knowledgeable and experienced and highly ethical. And you have FDIC insurance, and you have, you know, the bank has a very good capitalization, and they have intimate relations with the community that you're in, and you don't trust that, but you trust a website owned and controlled by somebody who you don't even know who they are.
That's a little risky.
And you know, and the price is extremely volatile. What are you doing? It makes no sense. So, you know, and this is the problem. When you lose trust in the establishment, you then have a very tricky time trying to figure out what's trustworthy and what's not. And that's why I wrote this report, because I really had so many subscribers and clients who were not thinking coherently about what's trustworthy and what's not and how to figure that out.
Oh, yeah. It's an amazing phenomenon, because when it comes to money, there's all of this wishful thinking. Of course, you know, Bitcoin's the one, and I'll put my money there and get away from that terrible fiat currency system. Not so fast.
It's the ultimate fiat currency system.
True.
You know, I could just see the guys in the deep state laughing, saying, this is fabulous. Let's get them all out of, you know, over here, we have to back the insurance, and it's a pain. If we could get them all over here on an uninsured basis, we're free.
Yeah.
You know, we have no obligations for government regulation, and, you know, so get them over here, because then it's not our problem.
Right. Now, just to be fair to all the Bitcoin enthusiasts that are listening, what are the redeeming qualities in Bitcoin? I mean, are there any?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. I mean, here's the thing. Bitcoin is something which is new. And there's no way that it has the governance and management structure available and seasoned, you know, a good seasoned community bank. But the reality is, you know, cryptocurrencies are going to happen for a variety of reasons. You just have to understand, if you put money in something that is that young and doesn't have the infrastructure, you know, you can lose 100%. So and the price is going to be very volatile. The value is going to be very volatile. And you just need to be prepared to treat it like a speculative investment.
Okay, so cautiously optimistic about Bitcoin's future. Now, when I see the explosion of these cryptocurrencies, I keep wondering where the black budget comes in all this. And I can imagine there's a big potential win in there for them. But where is the black budget harvesting, you know, its money these days? We know they've been great at working with drug money and federal subsidies like HUD, but where is their money focus now?
So I would say that's why financial fraud is, I mean, they're still doing the narcotics trafficking, but financial fraud is getting to be more and more important part.
Okay.
They can get everything on the internet and the digital systems, then they have a remarkable number of ways to skim. So I think that's where it's going. I think it's been in insider trading a long time, as well as, you know, if you look at the investment community, you're seeing more and more sort of the insiders peel off the returns, taking things private or doing them private, keeping it in the private space longer and taking, you know, skimming the returns. So I think there are a ton of ways they can do things. You know, they can do more globally. They can do more through the financial markets. And if they get cryptocurrencies broadly adopted, there's huge stuff they can do there. So
interesting.
I think the black budget is well and good. You know, the question I have, Daniel, is I've always said there's a great line in Jupiter Ascending. I think I played it at the Secret Space Program where the woman whose brother owns Earth, among other planets, turns to the person from Earth and says, you know, Earth is just a very small part of a much bigger corporation.
Huh.
And you look at that line and it fits exactly with the financial model. Because the question on planet Earth is, where is all this disappearing money going? Is it all just building underground bases, or, you know, are we a REIT and we're paying something, or are we paying a dividend that goes off planet? You know, we're basically being harvested financially. And the question is, where's the money going?
Yes, and this is intriguing and takes us back to the space report that you started off 2016 with. And that is just an incredible synthesis of what a major role space is playing in all of this. There's so many different elements in that space report, and it's so informative. I really recommend everyone read it. But one of the things that you had in there, you asked this question, and it was whether or not the global economy was an open or a closed system, which is very edgy, a question to ask, groundbreaking, I think, because no financial expert would touch it. But you approach the question, are we trading with an advanced human civilization in space, broken away from our own, or something else? So is it an open system?
Well, the economy is behaving much more like an open system than a closed. So one way I came at this is if you look at the debt, you know, coming into the bailout period, the developed world had become very leveraged. And then during the bailout period, we dramatically increased the debt in the developing world. And that's what sort of put us in a position where I did that big report last year called Planet Debt, and because the debt is extraordinary. And here's what's amazing. I found very good statistics. You know, the IMF, the World Bank, very good statistics and research on who's issuing how much debt. But then if you try and figure out, well, who owns it? You know, trying to find the statistics of who owns the debt and if governments have been issuing more and more debt, who's been buying it? You know, it's a big mystery. It's quite amazing if you can't find the statistics on that. And that's when I started to think about, okay, well, you know, are we trading with the dark pools? Are we trading off planet? You know, where is that going? It's funny, I was in 2001, I was at a investment conference in the city of London, and one of the money managers stood up and he said, the U.S. has now borrowed 80% of all the capital on the planet. You better hope that aliens exist, because that's the only place now we can go to get more money.
Oh, whoa.
So it was not what I was expecting to hear in the city of London, but I don't know if it's open or closed, but if you look at the scenarios that have been posited, you know, for many, many years now, I've been part of a group of people saying the economy is not going to collapse, it's going to slow burn.
Right.
And in fact, you have a whole world of people who say the dollar is going to crash, it's going to collapse. And if you listen to them and you listen to me, the difference between what we're saying is, they assume it's a closed economy, and I don't.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if it's open or closed, but I believe that, you know, the actual cash flows and credit are far bigger than what we're looking at or what the statistics show. So whether we're trading with a giant trust, which is in the dark pools and not in the statistics, or whether we're trading off planet, something is going on here that isn't captured in the official numbers. And so I just really believe it's essential for a financial person to make explicit their assumptions. And I can't answer the question how the governance system on planet Earth works. And I can't answer the question of where all this disappearing money is going. All I can tell you is the economy is behaving much more like an open economy than a closed.
Well, we started the year off with that very unusual 10-minute Pepsi commercial, adopting all of these themes from the alternative research community, like Tesla tracking a satellite in the 1890s. And they threw in some Sumerian Anunnaki lore, and they came on strong with UFOs coming back to visit us and all the rest. And, you know, it's a $1 million production. Now, it's pretty interesting. That's how we started 2016, and we've talked about both Clintons discussing a UFO disclosure on late-night TV. It's odd, and it makes me wonder if, in some way, the establishment is looking for an angle to turn this cultural awakening around to their advantage.
You know, I don't know. I think, here's the thing, Daniel. The conundrum they have is how do you get the general population to support pouring huge investment into space when they're disgruntled about their own personal financial situation? How do you do that? And I think if they are going to make disclosure, it's because they're looking for a way to build popular support for what they've been doing and to come up with an excuse for what they've been doing. And the problem with that is, you know, if it's true that I need to keep everything secret and steal lots of money to engineer a space program, I don't necessarily need to pay myself $250 million to do that.
Right.
You see what I mean? So the problem is not that they stole the money and spent it on space. The problem is they got $250 million. You know, Bob Rubin has a couple $100 million in his bank account, and that's really not something that the deep state needed. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think in terms of your space report, you mentioned driving across America and seeing these spaceports everywhere you went. So even if it wasn't being reported on by the media so much, the people working on it, living close to it, they knew that something, some infrastructure is being built up here.
Right. I mean, it's clearly there, and it's clearly part of the local conversation. You know, it's funny, when they ran the Boeing ad, I was kind of feeling when I published the space report, well, I guess once again, I'm a little bit, you know, I'm uncomfortably ahead of the curve. And then Boeing ad, and I was like, wait a minute, I'm not ahead of anything. They're playing this at the Super Bowl.
Yeah, they caught up.
And that and the Pepsi ad were a very strange feeling.
Oh, I completely agree. And there's no good regular explanation for that major production. It was such a huge message of some kind, with the Pepsi one in particular. And you pointed out with Boeing that they made the whole future tech look like a great thing. And of course, there are advantages to what can be done up there with space tourism and stations. That's what JFK was looking for with his space program, to reveal the stars. But unfortunately, these people in charge of this secret space program can't be trusted with that kind of power, and we should be greatly concerned whether it's space satellite surveillance or, you know, these Death Star weapons. We need to look at the danger that it will be misused.
I don't think the danger is that it will be misused. I think it is being misused now. You know, one of the biggest question marks in the development of space is space weaponry. And I'm highly confident that the U.S. has significant space weaponry, and that is probably and technically in violation of the treaties on space. And nobody wants to say anything because, you know, if you're certainly, if you're in the dollar-centric world, you want to support the dollar, maintaining reserve currency status. And that space weaponry is, my guess, is critical to doing that.
Wow.
And now what you've got is you've got a race by the Chinese and the Russians to do the same. Well, you know, all it takes is three or four countries having significant space weaponry, and we've got a real mess. So that's, you know, to me, if there's a conundrum, how do we get out of the risk of a real weapons race in space? Because I think one has started.
Well, it's Star Wars. We've been working on that, and now it's here. Very, very dangerous stuff. Catherine, just amazing information. Thank you. What a mind blower. The new report is Where to Stash the Cash in 2016. You can find it at Solari.com. And it's really great to see you. Incredibly mind-bending information and fascinating all the way through.
Sometimes when I talk about these things, you're like, whoa.
Well, a lot of light bulbs are going off here. So I'm still trying to catch up with your stuff. Thank you for joining me for this fascinating part two interview with former U.S. Assistant Housing Secretary Catherine Austin Fitz on Space Wars and Matrix Reality. You can find more deep interviews, special reports, and documentaries at www.darkjournalist.com. You can also subscribe here to our YouTube channel to receive the latest videos. See you soon.
Dark Journalist will go there. The deepest issues, the hardest stories, the biggest secrets. The truth is never easy. With top guests, like former Assistant Housing Secretary Catherine Austin Fitz.
Catherine, who is really behind this media censorship?
Internet feeds go through satellites. Who controls the satellites? It's the Pentagon.
Legendary investigator Graham Hancock.
Graham, this cataclysm must have destroyed an advanced culture in our ancient past.
It truly was an extinction-level event. It was accompanied by massive animal extinctions. It was accompanied by huge and unexplained sea level rises, and then a sudden plunge of global temperatures.
Best-selling author Jim Mars.
Jim, don't these elite corporate owners need us around to buy their GMO food? Why would they want to depopulate?
Because they are eugenicists and they believe that they need to purify the human race. And if that sounds like the Nazis, that's exactly what it is.
Coast to Coast AM investigative reporter Linda Moulton Howe.
Linda, how are we going to scale that wall of UFO secrecy?
Humans themselves are bypassing, are beginning to dismiss all of the policies of denial and lies.
Dark journalists will go there. Visit darkjournalist.com and subscribe now for a special summer discount available for just $39 for one full year. You'll not only receive access to the complete audio archives to stream or download at your convenience, you'll also get exclusive subscriber-only content and Dark Journalist event discounts. Sign up for our free newsletter to stay updated on the latest shows. Dark Journalist, let's get the real story in 2016.
You know, we need dark journalists, so just keep doing what you're doing.